Chapter 15. Vespa reclines on a mutagel cube, getting her head together while Jem chats in the background. It occurs to her that she ought to have settled into the room by now. It is a functional space without personality. Vespa wishes she were somewhere else. She wishes she were home, but there is no home to go to anymore. The Seven have destroyed it.
"We need to talk about Rela,"
Jem says, chewing on a flavoured vegetable stick.
"I know this has been hard on her, but she's getting into bad habits. You know she hasn't uttered a word since we left the Shining City."
"No."
"Not a single word. And you know it's your father's fault. Rela started copying him, and he's encouraging it."
She realizes that she should probably be getting ready and slowly starts to pull on her boots. Jem continues to talk. He sounds angry. She should probably do something about that.
"Rela nearly died following him into the ocean."
Vespa nearly drops her coat.
"What was that?" "I said she nearly died. Suns knows what would have happened if I hadn't gone after her and pulled her out, but he doesn't care. I'm starting to wonder if he's actually looking for a way to get himself killed, and us with him."
"He loves Rela. He always has."
"When you love someone, you look after them. You don't abandon them."
He waves the vegetable stick for emphasis.
"I'm telling you, you need to do something about him. He'll listen if it comes from you."
Vespa shrugs into her coat and moves the shoulder plates into position. She hates it when her family argue. The thought comes to her that Uncle Harm will sort it out, followed by the sure knowledge that he won't. That his soft voice will never take the heat out of their arguments again. She covers her mouth, clamping the sob inside before it can escape. Jem doesn't notice.
"Sorry to go on, but it's been unbearable, cooped up with him all this time. He hates me. Never says it, of course, but I see it in his eyes."
She moves to the door, nods. "I've got to go. I'll see you later."
"Already? Is everything all right?"
She doesn't turn to face him, picking up the sword and slinging it over her shoulder.
"Yes. Everything's fine." "But you are going to speak to him?"
"Yes.
I've just got something to take care of first."
Full of people, the audience chamber has an energy to it. Vespa drinks it in, accepting aid from any quarter. The leaders of the fragmented world are mostly present, together in the same space for the first time in living history. Representatives from Slake, New Horizon, Red Rails, West Rift, Verdigris, and the Thousand Nails all sit in their designated areas, staring down at her. She is mindful of the empty spaces waiting to be filled by the First and Near, and of the many people who have journeyed to her still waiting to be given a voice. But there is no more time. She has to act now. Vespa spreads her arms wide.
"Welcome. I can't tell you what it means to me that you're all here. I know we didn't exactly plan it this way, but before I get to what's coming, I wanted us to take a moment to appreciate where we are right now. For my whole life, it's been about survival. There was a war on, and people were either fighting the enemy to hold on to their homes or fighting their neighbours to get enough to eat that night. They say that the usurper won the Battle of the Red Wave, but that it lost the war against the Empire. That's only half true. The usurper did lose the war, but the Empire also lost, and everyone in the middle lost too. There were no winners in that conflict. Since then, we've all been fighting over what's left. Well, I say, no more. I say there's another possibility. One where we meet, as we're meeting right now, and make a different kind of future together. A safer future where we build something better. We're at the very start of what I hope is a new age, and what we decide here, she spreads her hands to encompass them all, will shape the world.
She pauses, lets it sink in.
So, with that in mind, there are a few simple rules that you've already been apprised of, but I want to reiterate here. One, everyone has the right to speak their mind. Two, everyone has the right to be heard. Three, everyone has the right to speak without interruption. Four, everyone has a right to hear the truth and only the truth. Five, this is no place for angry words or insults. Six, any of you who have a matter to lay before us are welcome to come down to the floor and do so.
She smiles, sheepish. That's all for now, but rules will probably develop as we find need of them.
For a while, the various delegations talk amongst themselves, leaving her to stand alone, exposed, unsure of what is to come. The man-shape is the first to speak. It has been ensconced on a high, hooded throne, modelled after the one in New Horizon. The back of the chair curls over, casting the man-shape's head in shadow, hiding it from view. Because of this, the assembled are spared the sight of its mouth contorting to make the right shapes.
This is a statement of intention. I am here to make peace with you. I have served those making a war on your world. It did not work. Your world changed us. It forced us into new forms. We did not ask to be this way, just as you did not ask for us to come. Your world changed us, and we changed your world. It is our world now. We must find a way to coexist, or we will surely destroy each other.
Vespa inclines her head in the man-shape's direction, grateful. There are gentle noises of support from the direction of Verdigris delegation and from the Prince of Red Rails.
Thank you, man-shape. Who wishes to speak next?
The rulers of Slake sit on elaborate seats constructed of sparkling chrome. Gorad leans forward, the old woman's smile patient, painted.
My colleague, Gutpumper, has a thought.
Gutpumper leans over as well.
More of a question, really.
Yes,
agrees Gorad.
More of a question. All of this talk of peace is well and good.
Lovely,
adds Gutpumper.
But the thing is, the Empire of the Winged Eye isn't interested in peace. They've been blowing up everything between here and the Shining City, and it doesn't look as if they're going to stop any time soon.
So my question is, begins Gutpumper.
His question is, when are we going to start talking about the Empire and how we're going to fight them?
We also wish this question to be answered.
This new voice comes from amidst the West Rift delegation, distorted by a breathing mask, anonymous. The group has not identified a single leader, deliberately obscuring their command structure. Vespa feels the attention of the room focus on her and the sudden bloom of heat on her cheeks.
I've heard what the Empire are doing, and of course we have to be prepared to fight if it comes to it.
She hears her words barked back from a few places, turned into exclamations.
If it comes to it!
If it comes to it!
Yes!
She says, raising her voice.
They haven't listened to anyone else, but they might listen to me. Before we fight, I'm going to try and reason with them.
Gorad taps her cane 3 times to get the room's attention.
If I remember correctly, rule number 4 says we have to have truth and only truth here. So I hope you'll forgive my...
being blunt? Suggests Gut Pumper.
My plain speaking. But when you set all this up, you spoke for the Empire. Now it looks to me like you don't speak for them no more. Looks like they want to burn you as much as the rest of us.
Maybe more, adds Gut Pumper.
So, if I'm honest, I'm wondering why we should listen to you at all.
Vesper's throat dries up. She has to fight to keep from drawing the sword. It is furious, and she is furious, and, pent up, that fury swats away any words of peace before they can get out of her mouth. From the area reserved for Verdigris, Tough Call clears her throat.
Way I see it, none of us would even be here if it weren't for Vesper. We'd be behind our walls waiting for the Empire to pick us off one by one. If it weren't for Vesper, we'd all have been eaten by the Yearning years ago. I know most of you by reputation, but I know Vesper by deed. She saved my city from a plague. Didn't have to, but she did. I reckon she's earned the right to have my ear. I don't reckon any of the rest of you can say that. With or without the Empire, I say that Vesper is the only one that we all actually trust. Unless you want me to run this show.
Tough Call looks around, meeting the eyes of the other delegations.
Thought not. So, until someone better comes along, how about we stop acting like gutter scavs and start listening?
The Thousand Nails roar their approval, and Vesper's next breath comes easier.
You have to decide for yourselves if you want to listen to me, but I have Gamma's sword, and that makes me the only one that the Seven might listen to. And if they don't, I'll stand with you and I'll make sure we win. I have my own knights and my own soldiers that will fight with us.
Somehow the sword is in her hand and her voice acquires a new resonance.
And I have bled for all of you. Is that not enough?
She sweeps the tip of the sword from one end of the room to the other.
It's up to you. Listen or don't listen, but I stand here, and I will speak. And nobody, not you, she points at Gorad, or you,
she points at Gut Pumper, then extends the sword straight out to her right,
and certainly not the Seven are going to stop me.
There is a long silence, filled by the vibrations of the sword. As the room stills again, Gorad and Gut Pumper exchange a look.
In that case,
says Gorad.
Yes, in that case, agrees Gut Pumper.
In that case,
repeats Gorad,
we're all ears.
Vesper strides out of the dome, needing air, needing to be alone. She manages to sheathe the sword, though she still feels its power tingling through her. Normally she would go to her room and shut out the demands of others, but the space is no longer empty, and, guiltily, she realizes that the thought of speaking to Jem is not a comforting one. She makes her way up the side of the valley, having to scramble up in places. It isn't dignified, but she doesn't care. It feels good to concentrate on something simple. As her body attends to the demands of the climb, the events of the meeting play out in her mind. Words are dragged over, analysed. Several times she winces at the memory of her tone, or how she struggled to answer a question, or the way some of the other leaders stared at her. Even worse, she finds gaps in her recollections, where the memory is emotional only. Disconnected. She reaches the top, flopping down, savouring the quiet. On the opposite side of the valley there is a great deal of industry. Fortifications continue to be built, and new arrivals appear in regular spurts, hurried, looking warily over shoulders. But on her side it is quiet. There is no reason for anyone to be there. The buck does not need a reason. He goes where he pleases, and for the moment that is close to Vesper. Nearby tufts of grass are picked at, restlessly, his dark eyes often on the lookout. Vesper reaches up to stroke his flank. If she closed her eyes, she could almost be home, a child, innocent again, dreaming of adventures in the shining city. Then a voice slaps her back to the here and now.
"A nice view, yes?"
she groans.
"Essay?"
"Yes, and it is good that I have caught you here."
"Not now, Essay. I need a bit of time alone."
"Ah, but this is the best time for us to be speaking, uninterrupted by others, where the only tongues wagging will be ours."
She looks up, sees her father slowly working his way up the side of the valley, and sighs.
"Go on, then."
"As you know, great lady, these are hard times. Eze has been working hard to give the people what they need. Much of this is like the children playing, and after a quick talk they leave, fresh meat on one shoulder, leather balls on the other for the recreation, and all is well."
He chuckles for a moment before letting his face fall.
"But,"
he holds up a finger, dramatic,
"there is one thing even Eze cannot sell."
He waits, and Vesper sighs again. "And what's that?"
"Much as it brings great sadness, Eze admits that he cannot sell hope. Not without you, great lady."
"What are you talking about?"
"Always you inspire. When the people see you striding about, your hair ready for war, and your eyes flashing like the lamps. But this is only in the day, and it is in the night that the fear creeps in. Imagine how it could be if the people could be touching you at night."
Vesper grits her teeth. "Seriously, what are you talking about?"
"Little Vespers!"
exclaims Eze, brandishing a small doll. Padded insides covered with flexible plastic give the texture of human skin, with face and clothes painted on.
"It doesn't even look like me."
"The people will not care so long as they are thinking it is you."
The vagrant is not far away now. She gives him a wave. He doesn't wave back, his attention on Eze.
"And who is this?"
asks Eze.
"He looks like a man from the Winged Empire. This is good. Their needs are always interesting."
"I doubt he'll want to buy anything."
"Then watch as Eze brushes away those doubts with the best offers around. See how the man gets quicker with anticipation."
Vesper frowns, and an eye opens at her shoulder, curious. The vagrant is moving faster, his hands clenched tight at his sides.
"Ah,"
says Eze, opening his arms.
"I see you are a man of purpose. You have come to the right place. Whatever help you need to fulfill this purpose, Eze can provide. Just unfold your desires, and we will soon find a suitable product to match them."
The vagrant comes to a stop in front of Eze, his chest rising and falling, air whistling angrily through his nose.
"This is not our first meeting, no? There is something familiar about the unhappiness in your eyeballs. Do not be sad, friend. If something has not been to your liking, perhaps we can trade.
The vagrant's hands slowly rise, opening. Vespa's frown deepens, and she starts to get up. Father, what is it? Eze's eyes widen.
Did you say fox?
The vagrant's hands encircle Eze's throat and squeeze. What are you doing? Vespa says. She goes to intercept, but one of the sword's wings grips her shoulder, telling her to wait. Sweat patches appear on Eze like magic, at armpits, across the chest, beads popping up all over his face. He begins pulling objects from his pockets, holding them up so the vagrant can see. A rat-fur moustache, a diamond choker made with real plastic, an unidentified tablet. The vagrant continues to squeeze, and more things appear. A sausage with dubious filling, a highly polished molar, an actual diamond. None of them catch the vagrant's attention. Veins now rise under Eze's skin, the sweat pouring freely.
Don't kill him!
Shouts Vespa. Again she is about to intervene. Again the sword squeezes her shoulder. Surprised, she looks at the sword for confirmation. An eye is staring at the scene, drinking it in, gleeful. Something in Eze seems to break, and the man sags. In defeat, he holds up a single platinum coin. The vagrant seizes it, and Eze drops to the floor, gasping. While the merchant wheezes at his feet, the vagrant examines the coin, then tucks it away. He looks down at Eze, and his fist lifts. He looks from Eze to his fist and back again, his expression dark. Then he glances at Vespa. Father? She asks. The vagrant sighs, his fist becoming a wave. As the pressure at her shoulder eases, Vespa moves to join him. Was that really necessary? He nods, confident, and she feels the sword thrum in agreement. Oh. Okay, then. She looks down at Eze. Are you all right? Unable to flap his mouth, Eze flaps his hands instead. I think you were right when you said you can't sell hope. The dolls aren't going to work out. People are going to have to make do with me. She turns to the vagrant. Come on. She leads him away, the buck trotting after them, leaving Eze to gasp in the dirt. When it is clear the threat has passed, he slowly sits up, rubbing at his neck as he watches them leave. He notices that an eye remains open at Vespa's back, looking at him, its silver wing raising in a gesture that, if it came from any lesser creature, he would swear was obscene. Vespa and the vagrant walk for a while, enjoying each other's company. It's strange seeing you in that armour, she says. When I was little, I used to imagine you dressed that way, like the knights in the stories Uncle Harm used to tell. At the mention of his name, tears spark in their eyes, but Vespa manages to keep talking. I know that really you were in that dirty old coat, but in my mind you'd always throw it off before fighting your enemies, and underneath it you were in sparkling mail from head to toe. It's funny what we think as children. The vagrant nods. I used to think the sword was enormous, but over time it's got smaller. The vagrant points at her, then holds out his hand at chest height, lifting it up. She laughs. I got bigger, I know. That's not what I mean, though. When I didn't know the sword, it was this scary thing I'd always been told to keep away from. At first, I was so scared of it, I didn't think of it as a person, like us.
Then one day I realized it had feelings too, that it wasn't this force of nature. It was just angry, and sometimes it could be scared too.
The vagrant tilts his head, non-committal.
I believe the same is true for the seven. Everyone else sees them as something better than us that's beyond question, but we've met them. We know they're not perfect.
This time the vagrant agrees without hesitation.
If I can find a way to get them to listen, I'm sure we could find a non-violent way to do this. There's already been too much bloodshed.
The vagrant puts a hand on her shoulder, gives it a gentle squeeze.
Do you think I can get through to them?
He tries to smile, but amber eyes only manage melancholy. Whatever else she is about to say is swallowed down as Genna arrives.
What is it? She asks.
The Empire's forces are almost on us. I've communicated your desire to talk to them.
Have they responded?
Not yet.
We should be ready for when they do. Tell Samael to gather my knights and meet me in front of the wall. Send word to Dr. Grains that he is welcome to join us. In fact, make it clear to all the delegations that they can send representatives with me if they want to.
Genna starts to turn, then stops, uneasy.
Are you sure that's wise? Your knights are using some kind of derived necrotech, and Samael is clearly infernal. If you take them with you, it will damage your chances of getting the Seven to listen.
But if I hide them, then I'm saying I'm ashamed, and I'm not. I'm proud to call Samael a friend, and I'm proud of my knights.
She sees Genna's look of concern and resists the urge to shake him.
Don't you understand? If this is going to work, the Seven need to see us as we are. They need to adapt to us.
I understand. But for what it's worth, I hope I'm wrong.
Vesper dismisses him, and she and the vagrant go back to Rila's room. Mazar reports there has been no trouble as she unlocks the door, allowing them both to go inside. Delta appears to sleep in one corner, a battered coat draped over her like a blanket. Rila lies next to her, pretending to sleep also. Vesper looks at them. The sword does the same. Her face becomes stern.
Wake up, she commands.
In the opposite corner of the room, Delta's sword stirs while Rila screws her eyes shut tighter.
Wake up, I said.
Silver eyelids flicker but don't open. The vagrant edges forward, scooping Rila off the floor and into his arms. Vesper draws the sword as he steps to the side, well out of her way. For a third time, she demands Delta's attention, the words seeming to thrum on the sword's edge, echoing, and Delta's eyes stretch open as if in shock. Vesper allows her own to close, the sword seeing for the both of them.
You've slept long enough. If you want to stay here, the least you can do is take an interest in what's happening.
Slowly, Delta raises her head, making eye contact.
I know that you don't agree with Alpha. Join your voice to mine. Together we have a chance to end this before things escalate.
Delta's words come softly from silver lips, like teardrops falling.
He will not listen. We don't know that.
A little certainty returns to the immortal's expression.
We do. Even if that's true, the others might. It could be enough.
Delta turns away, and her sword rattles on the floor. Vesper's voice lowers, becoming older.
Must I always be the one to get out there? Must I always be the one to suffer?
But I have suffered.
Vesper shakes her head and opens her eyes. Come on, she says to the vagrant. We have work to do. But as she moves towards the door, a sound stops her. Delta's sword is trembling on the floor. Alone, it lacks the strength to sing, but it manages to make itself heard, tapping on the ground, forcing out notes with effort, dull, muted. The vagrant goes and picks it up, offers it to Delta, hilt first. The immortal remains where she is, curled upon the floor, curled within her wings. Vesper gives her one last look before walking out. Slowly, the hilt of Delta's sword lowers. The vagrant sighs. Rela sighs. Delta's sword hums again, louder now, motivating, and Delta looks at it, a pained expression on her face. With a stamp of her foot, Rela goes over to Delta and grabs her little finger. Hold established, she starts to walk after her mother. The vagrant raises an eyebrow. Delta does not resist, flowing to her feet, a giant silver balloon gliding behind a stony-faced girl. They pass through the doorway, leaving the vagrant and Delta's sword to stare, then follow. While the journey south has been swift for the Knight Commander, it has not been pleasant. They have met little resistance, driving back the enemy by their mere presence, and yet he has felt a lowering of morale. For as they have travelled, the sheer scale of the problem begins to show itself. Gloomily, he watches the alien scenery go by his window. It is one thing to fight a demon or to cleanse a tainted body, but what do you do when the environment itself needs purging? He considers putting the fields they cross to the torch, but will they have to stop to bring flame to every blade of grass? And what of the deeper soil and the stone underneath that? What of the mountains around them? What of the very air itself? It is too big a thing to contemplate, and in the end the Knight Commander takes solace in his position. His job is to fight military battles, and he is happy to let the Seven worry for the world. One of his officers looks up from a screen. Knight Commander, our scouts report movement from the enemy base. A small force is coming out, heading our way.
What do we have on them?
They're on foot, armed but weapons stowed. The bearer is there, as is our former champion. The Knight Commander hears the surprise in the man's voice and is glad that he already knows of the champion's survival.
Anything else?
Sorry, sir, I'm just confirming the report. Yes, they say Delta herself walks with them, sir. How can that be?
How indeed? I asked for information, not questions, Captain.
Sorry, sir. The Order of the Broken Blades is present, as are a number of others, including a dogspawn. He paces the length of the command center twice, considering what is to be done.
I take it there's been no word from obeisance.
None, sir.
Resend my request. Notify me the moment you hear anything. I want a unit of our best brought forward, no more or less than the bearer's party. Match them man for man.
Yes, sir.
Have our generals prep their troops for action, but mark me, they are to hold position until I give the order, and keep the skyships back. I doubt their cloaks will hold up to the bearer's scrutiny.
You're not actually going to talk to them, are you, sir?
Don't look so worried, he says, as much to himself as to the captain. Are our scouts in place?
Yes, sir.
Good. Remind them that they are to close the door and hold it closed. Nothing more. I don't want any heroics.
Understood.
Be sure that they do, Captain.
He marches towards the exit hatch.
Only disturb me if a Bearsons calls or the sky falls down.
He knows he walks a delicate line. To attack without sanction would mean his doom one way or another. To not answer the bearer's call would look like weakness. He has to act and hope that obeisance responds while the enemy are still in his grasp.